I want to talk about philia. In our age, it's much harder to talk about this than about Storge and Eros. When those are your theme, you find a prepared audience. Their importance and beauty and value have been stressed and indeed exaggerated again and again. But very few modern people think friendship a relation of comparable importance. We readily admit that besides a wife and family, a man wants a few friends. But the very tone of the admission, the very meaning it gives to the word friends, make it clear that friendship is very far from being regarded as a main course in life's banquet, or even a course at all. It's more like the bread you crumble almost unconsciously during a long dinner. It's one of the etc. Why this has happened is well worth inquiring. The first and most obvious answer is that most people don't think about it because a great many people don't experience it. It's hard to get through life without encountering some kind and degree of both Eros and Storge. And of course it's impossible that life should go on unless many people felt both, because without Eros none of us would be begotten, and without Storge none of us would be reared. The peculiarity of friendship is that it's not unavoidable. Thousands of people have lived and died without knowing it. To be sure, 900 of each 1,000 will have had what we commonly call friends, people they drink with and play games with and chat with and cooperate with, perhaps amicably enough in their profession. But this useful and pleasant relationship is not of itself what I mean by friendship. There's lately arisen, too, a much nastier bit of evidence to show that the experience of philia is not universal. I mean, of course, the fact that if you speak of it with any seriousness, you are now quite likely to be suspected of homosexuality. This is extremely revealing. It doesn't at all prove that those who bring the charge are homosexual themselves, nor would I moralize upon them if they were. How a man can feel anything but bewildered pity for the genuinely homosexual, I've never been able to understand. What it does prove is that they have either never known friendship or never known Eros. For I appeal to everyone who's known both to bear me witness that in some ways nothing is so unlike a friendship as a love affair. Lovers talk incessantly about their love, friends hardly ever about their friendship. Lovers talk incessantly to one another about one another. Friends about anything rather than that. The characteristic posture of lovers is face to face, that of friends side by side. Admittedly, friendship between man and woman can turn into love, but the very fact that we can speak of turning into implies the difference. Of course, it's not to be denied that just as philia and normal Eros may be united in the relationship of a man to a woman, so philia and perverse Eros may be blended in a relation between persons of the same sex. In certain cultures, at certain periods, this has been common. In warlike societies, homosexuality is especially likely to creep into the relation between the mature brave and his young armor-bearer or squire. The Greek tradition of high heroic friendship is widely infected with paederasty, but things which can coexist are not, therefore, necessarily the same. They may, in the long run, be antagonistic. What might possibly confuse the issue is the fact that until quite modern times, male friendship normally expressed itself through kisses, embraces, and tears. Such behavior might be connected with a repressed erotic element, but no one with any historical sense could suppose this was always so. Its very prevalence proves the opposite. The erotic diagnosis has implications too comic to be accepted. I can't believe that Johnson embraced Boswell for that reason. The truth is, of course, that what needs explaining, what is anomalous and eccentric, is not the demonstrative gestures of old friendship, but the apparent coldness of ours. The marked repugnance which I, like many moderns, feel for any close physical contact with my own sex may itself be mildly pathological. Now, this modern suspicion of friendship by the amateur psychological wiseacres, the modern indifference to it shown by nearly everyone, the possibility of passing a whole life without experience of it, and the immense prestige which it once enjoyed and has now lost, are not unrelated phenomena. They all spring from one fact, the fact that philia is, in one sense, the least natural of the loves. It has least commerce with our nervous system. There's nothing throaty about it, nothing that quickens the pulse or makes you red or pale. It's not, in its full development, a biological necessity. The individual can live and breed and protect himself without it. Eros and Storge are too obviously connected with the body, too widely shared with the beasts, too closely linked with biological necessity. In them, one could almost feel that nature pulls the strings and we are the puppets. In philia, on the other hand, we have the feeling, whether illusory or not, of being free from all that. Hence, friendship alone of all the loves seemed to our ancestors to raise us to the level of gods or angels. Thus, some men have exalted and others have depreciated or denied the love called philia for exactly the same reason. Because in it, man seems furthest removed from the animal, from the irrational, and from necessity. This does not seem to me a good ground either for praising it or disparaging it. For, as I said before, nothing in man is either better or worse because he shares it with the beasts, nor does anything need to be justified by its survival value. The things which make survival worth having are not to be rated below the things which enable us to survive. If everything that's not harnessed to the biological wagon is to be called perversion, then we must say, as I said before, that humanity itself, and the more human the more so, is the greatest perversion of all. In early communities, the cooperation of the males as hunters or fighters was no less necessary than the begetting and rearing of children. Long before history began, we men have got together apart from the women and done things. We had to. We not only had to do the things, we had to talk about them. We had to plan the hunt or fight, and when they were over, we had to hold a post-mortem and draw conclusions for future use. We like this even better. In all these pleasures, there was a savour quite different from anything we usually experienced in our relationships with the women. Meanwhile, of course, the women were doing things together apart from us. Being a man, I naturally know less what they were like. But I know, as all men know, in my very bones, what the men were doing. As some wag said, the caveman may or may not have had a club on his shoulder, but he quite certainly had a club in the other sense, a place where he sat and talked and talked. It was very probably part of his religion. But all this is not yet friendship. I don't at all want to undervalue the merely clubbable element in our lives. It's necessary. And perhaps of all relationships, camaraderie produces the fewest pains and the most pleasures, often wholly innocent and recreative pleasures. A life without it would be crippled. And for my own part, I have the deepest suspicions of those wretched people who find no pleasure in the society of their own sex. Heaven protect me from the man who needs only women and the woman who needs only men. But at the same time, we must insist that friendship is not simply camaraderie or companionship. Those who don't experience friendship or philia proper think that friend means only comrade or companion, one with whom we can collaborate easily or spend our leisure agreeably. But those who know philia make a distinction. Among their 100 or so comrades, only 5 or 6 may be in the true sense friends. Of course, in ordinary conversation, they apply the word friends to the whole 100. But that is a façon de parler, a polite fiction, like the adjective dear at the beginning of a letter. Those whose society we enjoy may fail in 2 different ways to qualify for the title of friends. First, we may enjoy a man's conversation without liking the man. He may be highly intelligent or amusing. So long as he will talk on a subject we want to learn about, or so long as he makes good jokes, we may be delighted. The moment the conversation moves on to a deeper level and forces us to attend to his personality, we may be repelled. We may even receive from him pleasures we're ashamed of, as when we listen to a scandalmonger. There are, it's true, people who seem never to make this distinction. Liking a man and liking his talk are for them all one. The confusion is elementary, but we needn't be surprised at it when we remember that other people can't distinguish between liking an actor's performance and liking the actor as a man, nor between enjoying a book and imagining that they like the author. But everyone can understand the opposite situation, in which we like the man, but find his society rather dull. And so also there are wits whom we enjoy without love, without esteem, and without confidence. Secondly, there may be a man with whom, while we live in the same place or share the same job, while we have the same recreations, we seem to be in the relation of friendship. Then the chances of life separate us. We meet him 5 years later, and find that when the first lighted greetings have passed and a few reminiscences have been interchanged, we have hardly a word to say to him nor he to us. Neither of us need have changed at all seriously in character, yet both have mistaken for a deep union of personalities what was really only a common stock of aims, hardships, hopes, fears, triumphs, annoyances and jokes externally provided by the place or job they happen to share. Now, it's just here that the friend is most clearly distinguishable from the companion. After almost any tract of time or any change of residence or occupation, the old unity will be intact. Everything will be taken up again as if we'd been parted only for a few hours. We've no need to fall back on reminiscences, though we may do so for the pleasure of it, but we're not reduced to them, whereas the attempted revival of mere companionship has no other coin. The difference between mere companionship and friendship depends on the nature of the shared activity. The men of the tribe sit talking together because they are all hunters and warriors. Take the individuals apart, place them for a few years in different cultures, using different techniques, facing different problems, and then reassemble them. I very much doubt if the old companionship, the old club, would come to life again. For the bond of union lay in their functions, not in the personalities of each. But if in that prehistoric club there had been two who went sometimes apart to talk of something which the rest had no bent for, two who were groping their way towards the beginnings of art or philosophy or religion, then I should expect that those two, at such a reunion as I'm imagining, would resume their old relationship. They are linked together not as warriors or trappers, but as men, as the very two men they were and are. The activity they shared, they always will share as long as they are the same men. As Montaigne says, a man is my friend because he is he, because I am I. Whereas a man is my comrade because he is my colleague or neighbor or ally. But does not Eros, does not the love between man and woman also say, because she is she, because I am I? Certainly, but Eros doesn't mean quite the same thing. Eros means, because she is my goal, my journey's end, my quarry, because I need her and she me, because we are key and lock, thirst and water, seal and wax. But friendship means, because he has the same goal, because he is taking the same journey, because he is hunting the same quarry, because we are both filled with the same need. I am speaking, of course, of Eros here in a sort of chemical purity from which, thank God, he is usually preserved in ordinary life, where happy Eros is nearly always combined with storge and very often with friendship too. Now, by saying that Eros can be combined with friendship, I have, you noticed, assumed that there can be friendship between a man and a woman. There are people who don't believe this. They think that any apparent instance of it is usually a disguise for Eros or the beginning of Eros. And there are also people who think there are no true friendships between women and women. Both views are, in my opinion, wrong as generalizations, but I am afraid they are likely enough to be true of many societies or classes within societies at certain periods. Companionship is the soil out of which friendships grow, and where the soil is lacking, of course, the plant will not exist. Where men work and women don't, or where they do quite different work, or again, where men are educated and women not, or where the sexes have different educations, there will be no companionship, and therefore no friendships between the sexes. They can meet only in Eros and Storge. For I don't think lovers can be, in the true sense, friends as well as lovers, unless they are the sort of man and the sort of woman who would have been friends even if they had not fallen in love. But quite often, though there was no companionship between the sexes, the women have had their own companionship parallel to and distinct from that of the men. In many primitive communities, they go together to the washing pools or to sow the fields. A whole female life, with its own labors, rituals, sometimes even its own language, is built up, and the men are as jealously excluded from it as the women are from theirs. That is one possible and tolerable state of affairs. Friendships between women and women, friendships between men and men, but none between the sexes. Another possible state of affairs, which I like very much better, is that which we see nowadays in those societies where men and women, rarely equal in education, collaborate in the same professions and have the same tastes. Real friendships can then arise both between women and women, and between women and men, and between men and men. But unfortunately, there are in the modern world quite a number of women who get the benefit of neither system. Such is many a well-to-do married woman in our own professional classes. What work she does, and labor-saving gimmicks have left her little to do, is done alone in her own flat or house. Other women are not her colleagues or comrades. They're merely visitors or neighbors. On the other hand, she may be totally unfitted for any real companionship, hence for any real friendship, either with her husband or with any of his circle. Of course, she has had what is officially, almost ironically, called an education. But if her husband and his friends are, say, doctors, clergymen, lawyers, scholars, or scientists, she is, for all the practical purposes of companionship with them, uneducated. They can't talk to her about the sort of things friends talk about. I don't mean merely the shop of their particular professions, but the whole world of ideas which presupposes a highly educated mind. Of course, affectionate husbands and polite, long-suffering friends will pretend it is otherwise. And, of course, an aggressive woman will insist on being treated as if it were otherwise. But neither expedient helps. She can be taken to the right party. She may be laboriously dragged into the conversation. Her interruptions and misunderstandings may be endured with smiling patience. But she hasn't really got into the circle. The moment she joins it, it ceases to be the circle it was. Her very presence destroys it. She has frustrated the others and is frustrated herself. One cannot be surprised if she comes in the end to hate and fear friendship as the enemy of Eros and Storge, the only love she can ever really have. I'm very sorry for the woman in this position. She has fallen between two stools, has lost the old camaraderie with her own sex, yet not advanced to the stage in which she could be the friend on a different level, either of women or of men. But I not only pity her, I also fear her. A huge, glossy, and expensive weekly and monthly literature now exists for just such women. Through that, her fear and hatred of philia may be becoming influential. Friendship is a development from mere companionship or camaraderie. It could indeed be defined as companionship transferred to a deeper level, transferred to those desires, fears, hopes, or delights which make us the precise people we are. Hence, the very first step in friendship is not a movement of liking towards another man. That is the second step. First comes the shared activity. To care about something other than friends, even if it were only a hobby, is the precondition of friendship. If you're going nowhere, you can have no traveling companions. If you've nothing to share, you can share nothing. Friendships always come, if they come at all, unasked, unsought, as Keble said. Friends don't talk much about one another, nor about their friendship. On the eve of a long parting, in danger, in sorrow, they may express the deep love and unshakable loyalty that's between them. The very rarity of such explicitness may even make it especially poignant. But friendship would lose its essential character if they were frequent. The fact that friendship is thus normally unexpressed and merely implicit helps to conceal from some observers the truth that it's a form of love at all. It is manifest far more in its results than in any direct emotional impact, as a man's love of God is better gauged by the tenor of his whole life than by his moments of what the theologians call sensible consolation. This comes out strongly in its reaction to bereavement. We may feel, in one sense, and at the moment, the death of a great friend less than the death of someone or something which we love with very moderate storge, even an animal. The one may fill our eyes with tears, the other not. But the death of the object loved with storge may, after that momentary and not wholly painful tenderness, make hardly any difference to our lives. The death of a friend may impoverish us every year or every month till we die. We are like a man who has lost a limb. The stub may not ache, or not much, but no more tennis, no more mountain walks. Write it all off. Again, the seriousness and importance of friendship is masked for some people by a characteristic which is really its glory. It is unnecessary. It is arbitrary, a thing of choice. We are no way obliged to make any man a friend, and we have no claim that any man should become ours. It is more merely disinterested than any other love. Friends may be useful and may increase our happiness, but it's impossible to make them our friends with this in view. In a word, it's free. And with this freedom goes a certain noble irresponsibility. I hope the word won't be misunderstood. Of course, we have responsibilities to every man. Every man is his brother's keeper. And if to leave any man unhelped or uncomforted, when help and comfort are in our power, is bad, so to leave a friend is worse. But such good offices are not the stuff of friendship. They're a byproduct. The mark of perfect friendship is not that help will be given, of course it will, when the pinch comes, but that, having been given, it makes no difference at all. It was an anomaly, a distraction. It has interrupted the conversation. For, of course, friends don't want to know one another's affairs at all. You can become friends with a man before you know whether he's married or single or how he earns his living. In a circle of true friends, each man stands for nothing but what he is. No one cares about anyone else's family or professional status or class or regional origin or nationality or previous history. In fact, all the things biographers want to know, they care nothing about. In time, of course, all these things will be revealed, but not for their own sake. They will come in accidentally. That is the delight of philia, the contact of stripped or disentangled souls. For eros, naked bodies. For friendship, naked personalities. You'll notice that I've passed inevitably from speaking of a pair of friends to speaking of a group. Two is not, in fact, the perfect number for friendship. Hence, though jealousy can creep in here, as where not, friendship is by nature the least jealous of all loves. Two friends will be glad to be joined by a third, and three by a fourth. When two or three or five of us, after a hard day's walking, have come to our inn, when our slippers are on and our feet spread out towards the blaze, and our drinks are at our elbows, and the whole world and something beyond the world opens itself to our minds, and no one has any claim on or any responsibility for any of the others, but all freemen and equals, as if we just met half an hour ago, while nonetheless an affection mellowed by the years is there and fills up the chinks, then we may well wonder whether on the natural level there is anything better than this. And of course, in a sense, nothing is. Nothing is ever better than what's best in its own kind. The greatest wine cannot be better than a slice of perfectly good bread. It's no wonder, then, that past ages thought friendship the crown of life. It is the least jealous, the least demanding of loves, almost free from self-interest, immune from the internal corruptions of storge. It can, as the ancients thought, be a school of virtue. If men are good at all, they become better by mutual friendship. Each lives up to all the rest. We could easily be tempted to regard it, not merely as an analogy to, but a real foretaste of, the heavenly unity. Notice, however, that Scripture has not chosen this sort of love as the symbol of divine love. It has chosen storge, God is our Father, and we his sons. It has chosen eros, Christ is the bridegroom of the church. More than that, the most completely animal and self-regarding of all our appetites has been chosen to become the vehicle of our most strictly commanded communion with God. Eat this, drink this. It looks as if God, or God's plans for our redemption, were not in the common sense of the word, half so spiritual as the higher paganism supposed. He seems to descend deepest into nature when he intends to lift us highest. Blood and guts and glands and genes and things of that sort don't repel him. Negative spirituality, departure from the animal and the instinctive, doesn't of itself seem to please him particularly. By its spirituality, friendship escapes some of the obvious dangers of the other loves. Its danger lies precisely in its spirituality. Consider how a circle of friends, such as I've been describing, appears from outside. Almost every name given to it is in some degree unpleasant. It's a set, a coterie, a gang, a mutual admiration society. To belong to a group of real friends is to be armed, in a degree which friendless men can't imagine, against influences from without. The public opinion within the group may be tiny, but it matters more than the opinion of 10,000 outsiders. The approval of those whom we love and honor is the approval we value. Every knot of friends is thus a resistance movement. And, of course, the external pressures which it arms us to resist may be good ones or bad ones. In it we may retreat into something better or worse than the public world. It may be a nursery of martyrs or of criminals. In real life, friendship can unite by what is still good in them, men otherwise very bad, and thus fortify them in evil. There can, for example, be an aristocratic caste, very cruel and unjust to the rest of the world, but quite genuinely united within by friendships, mutual loves, honor, and courtesy. The more real and even lofty the friendship within such a caste is, the more it may steel their nerves and stop their ears to all claims from without. The same man who would die for his brother in arms might not deny himself one bottle of wine or one game of cards to save a village of peasants from massacre. The sufferings and the moral judgments of outsiders don't affect him. It's the approval of his friends that matters. Friendship, as we've seen, is based on sharing at depth of activities and attitudes, a relation between souls side by side. The things shared may be good or bad or mixed. Friendship doesn't transform them. It raises them, for good or ill, to a higher power and gives them more confidence. It makes brave men braver, kind men kinder, pious men more pious, cruel men more cruel, proud men more proud. It underlines, endorses, sanctions, defends either from true or from false shame, whatever they were doing already. If you and I want to evade some dangerous duty, the best plan is to find two or three other cowards and do our shirking in company. It's wonderful how little discomfort you'll feel when we've talked it all over and laughed it all over together. Equally, if we have to stand out against a real evil, to risk embarrassment and jeers and the possible loss of a job, the best plan is to get together with two or three other honest men. The ordeal will become amazingly less formidable. Friends, in a word, give us moral support, or immoral support. I've glanced at extreme examples, but they're extremes of a moral ambivalence which is inherent in friendship. It can be a school of individual humility, but with this individual humility, how easily there comes a corporate pride. I may be unworthy, but we, the set, are magnificent. Loyalty to the spirit of a noble circle, adherence to its standards, has so often proved for us the road to goodness that we may come to mistake it for goodness itself, to stand by our friends, to stick to the firm, to go down with the ship. These things being almost absolutes, may become absolutes. Aucassin, in the story, said he would rather go to hell with the knights and ladies and troubadours than to heaven with the hermits. Now, a man must be very good, or, and that's the trouble, very bad, not to feel in himself a response to that gesture. A kind of heroic loyalty is often mixed with that corporate impenitence which binds bad men together in their last stand. Friendship is a resistance movement. It can resist God as well as society, and yet all the time by a kind of goodness, or what had been goodness in it. Friendship is the most spiritual loves, and therefore its corruption the most spiritual corruption. A certain kind of mother may be like a man-eating tigress, a certain kind of lover like a rutting animal. Storge and Eros can fall by animality. But friendship gone wrong liberates not the animal in man, but the titanic or diabolical. It is high-minded. It can have proud looks. By its nature, it must and should defy popular opinion. It may go on to defy mercy and justice and God himself. This love, too, can breed unlove. Nothing, not even friendship, is good except goodness.